Hi, my name is Shruti.
I'm Abhishek.
And I'm Navneet, and we are InSciComm. We bring you a new podcast series where we will profile enthusiastic students, scientists, and science communicators. Each of them will talk about who they are, what they do now, how they got here, and a cool scientific concept. We call this a soupçon of SciComm.
Should we start?
All right.
Okay.
Let's start.
So we have somebody who is a neuroscientist and a budding electrophysiologist, and he is currently transitioning between a PhD and a postdoc. So question number one, who are you and what do you do?
Hi, Shruti. Thank you. I'm Srinivasan. Mm-hmm. And by profession, I would like to call myself a cellular biologist. It's a tough question because I've been working on two big fields, field of neuroscience and field of marine biology. So when I'm with a group of marine biologists, I call myself marine biologist. When I'm with a group of neuroscientists, I call myself neuroscientist.
So that you blend in perfectly well.
Yes. But what I would like to call myself going forward is a cell biologist. The past few years, what I've been doing is I've been working on building this platform that we can use to easily look at different types of cells.
Mm-hmm.
So just to survey different types of cells.
Mm-hmm.
There are billions of cells in the human body,
mm-hmm.
but there are many, many kinds.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is there's not a very easy way to look at these cell types.
Mm-hmm.
So I was working on developing this platform.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, it's very important to identify or define the characteristics. For example, there are billions of people on this planet,
mm-hmm.
and everyone is unique, right?
Yeah.
So we have different ways of defining people based on their color of their skin, color of their hair, their gender. For cells, we don't have those features very crisp. So I've been working on finding what are these best features that we can use,
mm-hmm.
and what are the combinations of these features that we can use to
mm-hmm.
describe these cell types.
That's a lofty goal, but like a fantastic goal. It's like you want to build an encyclopedia of cell characteristics. Is that
right? Exactly. I think that's a good way to put that. That's right.
Cool. Okay. Question number two. How did you get where you are right now?
Long journey. If
mm-hmm.
you want to ask me how did I become a scientist, well, I can tell you that.
You can tell me your spiritual journey into becoming a scientist. You can also tell me your academic journey to becoming a scientist. I think both are equally valid journeys.
I think a lot of people before have asked me this question, how
mm-hmm.
did you choose to become a scientist?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is I did not choose. It
mm-hmm.
was when I was in third grade.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers ask you, what do you want to become when you grow up?
Yeah, you know, like
yeah.
they ask kids.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then at that time, I think I wanted to become a teacher because teachers had all the answers to my questions. And I wanted to be this person who had all the answers in the world. So I go home and I tell this to my mom that, you know what, I want to become a teacher.
Uh-huh.
And she asked me, why do you want to become a teacher? Said the same thing that, you know, I want to find all the answers. And then she said, but there are some questions that even teachers don't know. But you know what? Scientists know a lot more answers. So maybe you should become a scientist. So when she told me, I thought, oh, okay, maybe I should become a scientist. So that's how I decided that I want to be a scientist.
That's fantastic. She actually steered you in the right direction.
So it was my mom who said, like, you know, become a scientist, and I became one. That's it. Once she found that I have this passion or curiosity for different things, knowing
mm-hmm.
different things,
mm-hmm.
most of the parents do. She took me to places.
Mm-hmm.
And I think over the years, I was lucky that I had many good teachers
mm-hmm.
who steered me into the right direction when they spotted my interest at that point.
Mm-hmm. On that note, we can shift to the academic side of what you've been doing.
So when I was in 12, I had this dilemma whether I should choose science or engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to do pure sciences.
It's weird that we still have this sort of split. I mean, science and engineering should kind of go together.
Exactly.
Wouldn't you think so? I mean, I would think so. And it's weird that we're making high school, and it's weird that we're making high school kids choose between science and engineering as if they're like two different things. But like
that's
in reality, right. I feel like there's no difference between the two. You
they
have to study science.
They're interdependent. Exactly. I think
exactly.
they're very interdependent. But I think unfortunately, we still have the mentality of choosing one for job security. You have
to be
technology or engineering and have a secure job.
Right.
If you're in sciences, you'll be exploring.
Yeah, but then the job security is not so much in science, which like automatically devalues it for like so many people right in the get-go.
So when I mentioned that, my biology teacher at that point, she knew that I'm interested in pure biology, but my dad wanted me to be in
engineering.
IT.
Oh, so, IT. Oh my God, not even engineering, like very specifically IT. Okay.
So the best option at that time was to take industrial biotechnology, which had a mix of both technology and biology. And he agreed to that.
Nice.
But it was difficult to find a good university that offered biotechnology. So I enrolled in a 5-year integrated master's program at Shastra University and a great school for biotechnology. So that's where I spent 5 years, did my bachelor's and master's. And it's there at Shastra that they had many opportunities and options to explore sciences. So my mentor at that time, Dr. Vijayalakshmi, she spotted that I was interested in marine biology.
Nice.
And she said, look at Toto Oliveira lab and start following his work. And I was following his work when I was an undergrad. And Shastra offered the scholarship to top 10 students at the university to finish their thesis work. So I was one of the top 10 students who got that scholarship from Shastra to do my master's thesis. So in my final year, I wrote to Professor Oliveira that, hey, you know, I have a scholarship and I would like to work in your lab. And then, yeah, I was lucky. He accepted me. He said, yeah, sure, come over here and do your thesis. So I spent 6 months working in his lab on my master's thesis. This is where I was exploring the marine biology part of my life, where I was interested in cone snail biology, venomous cone snails. I liked working here. And then I expressed my interest to join his lab as a PhD student. So I applied for PhD. And this was the only place I had applied for my PhD.
So. Oh, wow. You were not only confident, but you were also very lucky.
Yes, I think it was both. So I got into here and did my PhD with him.
Excellent.
But there were a lot of rejections before that. When I was applying for my thesis project, I had applied to many labs, almost 30 labs.
Wow. Within the University of Utah?
No. This was in India.
Oh, I see.
I actually thought my professional trajectory would be equip myself enough to impress Professor Oliveira that, you know, I can work in a different lab and then do some cone snail research in a different lab. And then I write to Professor Oliveira, I can say, oh, I have this experience.
Right.
Would you pick me? Because I'm interested in it.
Right.
Got rejected by all the 30 labs for many reasons. They were like, oh, we don't have lab space. We don't have money.
Right.
And I was so frustrated that I finally wrote to Professor Oliveira himself.
Which you should have done in the first place.
And I was like, what is the worst that can happen? He'll reject me too.
Right.
But he was the one who accepted it. So it goes on to proving that you don't really need prior experience. I was very worried when I was applying to his lab that I need to have some expertise and experience. But it's not important. Now, in retrospect, I can tell students or people that just the passion and honesty and sincerity.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes that's what professors are looking for. They're looking for like the drive and the passion and the curiosity to find a question and sort of see through to the end. So it makes perfect sense.
So yeah, that's how I decided to do my PhD with him, and it's worked out. So
excellent.
6 years of PhD with him. Yes.
Excellent. Well, you're about to finish, so congratulations, and you've already defended your thesis, so you are Dr. Raghuraman. And finally, we come to question number 3, which is: imagine you have the power to go back in time to when you were in high school or undergrad. Can you pick and explain one concept to your younger self that you think is the coolest, most important, or most awesome in your field?
It's tough because I was very dumb. So
that's okay. Explain it to yourself to make it interesting.
One of the coolest things was, one concept I would say is, there are many biological interactions going around that I wasn't aware of. So going back in time, I would say, look for so many creatures that are around you and observe their interactions. And also find out the interactions between animals under the sea. A lot of animals survive in a symbiotic relationship by where they both benefit each other, but also there's this prey-predator relationship. And one of the coolest prey-predator relationship is between cone snails and fish. cone snails are, marine cone snails are venomous. They are packed with a very powerful cocktail of venom that they use to hunt fish, worms, and other sea creatures.
So you're telling me snails hunt for fish?
Fish, yes. It's,
and when you say hunt, like all I can think of is like a running cheetah or a lion. And when you say snail, all I can think of is a thing that does not move very fast.
Exactly. I think that is what is mind-blowing about these snails, right? So you wouldn't expect snails to be hunting around. They are these shy creatures that will shrink back into their shells.
Right.
But here you have these amazingly complex snails that have evolved this complex cocktail of venom to capture food. So that is enough for me to know when I was in 12. I think that will instigate my curiosity to know more about these things.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Can you give us like an example of one snail or one mechanism that you thought was like really cool as you were going through your PhD work?
It's actually very amazing how the biology of cone snails is, or how the anatomy is. We still don't know a lot about the biology of snails and their interactions with their, either with their own predators or their own prey. One of the coolest features was the different hunting strategies different types of snails use. So imagine I give you an egg. You have different ways of cooking your egg. You can scramble it depending on which part of the world you are in. Let's say, you know, if I give it to a French, it'll be different cooking. Indian, different. Similarly, snails have different ways of eating, or they have different feeding strategies. Some of them open their mouth and spray around toxin into the water. And that makes a bunch of fish go wonky and they are very drowsy. And the snails can go and capture them. Other snails are very shrewd. What they do is, instead of opening their mouths and spraying around toxin, they wait around in crevices. And when they sense fish, they take out this harpoon-like teeth. So you can look at the molecular picture of these, or you know, shape of these two, that they actually are like harpoon. They're shaped like harpoon.
Wow. And wait, they're like kind of teeth, or they're like an organ that's specialized that come instead of teeth?
So they are teeth.
They are teeth. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're basically, it's in a sack basically. So just, they don't have it in their mouths stuck like our teeth.
Right.
But they keep it as a reserve. So
right, as an accessory sack.
Yeah. They have hundreds of these harpoon like teeth, so they are like toothpicks basically, but they're shaped like harpoons. So you know, so that once they inject it to the fish, they can tether it and reel it back, so they are literally going fishing.
So my god, so the other end of the tip of the harpoon is connected back to the sack.
Yeah, so it's basically saying connected to the tube that they get, and it's a venom duct. And I think their mouth muscles are strong enough that they can hold it.
Right.
And can reel it back to their mouth.
Wow.
So,
I can totally imagine like a tiny snail having a small, having like a small label on it saying gone fishing, and like, you know, throwing out these venom harpoons. So,
what's cool about these tooth is also that they're hollow. So they are like hypodermic needle, so that they can use the same needle to inject venom. And also use it to tether fish.
So there are snails that use it without the venom, and then there are snails that use it with the venom, or is it usually almost always with the venom?
It's usually, if they have a tooth, it's always with the venom. So they will be venomous, they'll inject venom and they'll take it. So there are many ways these snails feed on. We only know about these feeders. One, that they spray around toxin and capture schools of fish. We call it net hunter. And then the other, that use these teeth to go fish. We call them taser and tether strategy, where they taste the fish and tether them.
So oh my god, that's giving me like amazing views of fish like being tasered to death.
Yep. So those are cool science concepts I would be telling my younger self. And also, those are only two that have been extensively studied. There are so many other strategies and feeding behavior we are yet to uncover. And more recently, we uncovered a very new way of feeding. These snails are called vampire snails.
Snails.
They have a duct, and you can see that, you know, it's stuck to the fish. The fish is pretty large compared to the size of the snail. But somehow they have figured out a way to anesthetize these fish. So the fish is sleeping, and then you can see these snails slowly sucking blood out of the fish.
Whoa!
And then they feed themselves. Whoa. We don't know how they're able to do that. We don't know how they're able to attack the fish or how they are anesthetizing the fish. But throughout the whole feeding time, the fish is asleep. And as soon as the snail is done feeding, then this fish slowly comes out of anesthesia and then it's just, you know, thrashing and swimming away.
So the fish doesn't actually die.
It doesn't die.
And the cone snail feeds exclusively on fish blood.
Yes.
That is fantastic. I did not even know such a thing existed.
This is a new work. I think it's some of the scientists in Italy, some of the collaborators of the lab have found that out. But we are very excited to now look at this strategy as well and see what are these snails, how are they anesthetizing the fish, and how are they preventing the blood clot? Because, you know, when you're feeding on exclusively on blood, how, what are the anticoagulants that are there?
Right. This is like similar to a mosquito or a leech, you know, that kind of hangs on and then the blood doesn't clot.
The blood out. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that it will be very interesting to look at these parallels, you know, like you point out. Are these mechanisms similar in all these animals? Mm-hmm. Are they using different things to achieve the same common goal?
Right. Like, is it independently evolved to like a common goal?
Yeah.
Thank you again for saying yes. If it ever happens that we do invent time travel, I hope your younger self is very happy because you told him about feeding strategies of cone snails.
Yep, I think I'll learn about them much earlier, but I guess I'll still take the same trajectory of what I've taken.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
It'll be fun.
Super. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shruti. Thank you so much.
And that's it for this episode of Sousan of SciComm. And stay tuned for our next episode where we talk about fishes with superpowers.